Summer movies, summer TV, a news cycle that not only does not take the summer off, it doesn't seem to pause for even an hour. These are among the items in our media landscape. And we do take a broad definition of the media, everything from today's tweets to classic books, into our monthly visit with the Signals and Noise team. Our regulars on the segment are members of the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University, Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay, in the studio with me once again. Good to see you guys again. I understand you're both teaching for the summer, so staying busy.
Yes, we are.
Hi, good morning.
I want to talk, we were talking about a couple of issues involving the way in which people will take video from today's world and apply something else to it. Mm-hmm. We'll get to, for example, the image that Donald Trump retweeted of himself from years ago, punching a figure that they then grafted the CNN logo onto the face of. But there's even a fresher one than that, because Kellyanne Conway apparently was on Sean Hannity's show on Fox yesterday and used some flashcards to talk about what she was to wear. You know, is it collusion? Is it confusion? Is it delusion? That sort of thing. And, of course, as happens in today's world, by this morning, just a few hours after the show last night, people had placed all kinds of things over the flashcards. I mean, this seems like something that you're almost asking for people to do if you bring any sort of visual props out for anything political.
Yeah, it wasn't even this morning. As of last night, I checked my Twitter feed about 11:30 p.m. before I went to bed, and people were already memifying this image. And you know, one tweet I saw said, you know, you never bring white cards on TV. You're immediately asking to be a meme. It's interesting how, you know, people really have to think ahead. And I think what's interesting is I think she actually was trying to be a meme. I think she was trying to create a visual image that would be shareable, right, and that Trump fans would share, but, you know, maybe didn't think through the ramifications of how easily it is to manipulate images and replace those words.
But that brings us to an interesting point in the current media landscape, where even though you know someone might take your work and run with it in a different direction, you can actually use that to your benefit upon occasion.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's a way of getting your image and your word and yourself out there. One of the things that I always tell students why it is important to be on social media is because it gives you a type of presence. So even if it's silly or ridiculous, people are still thinking about you in some type of context. You're not forgotten.
It's just a way to keep your face popping out of the crowd, I guess, up to
right.
a point.
Mm-hmm.
All press is good press, that kind of idea.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So which raises the larger question of how the world operates on a Twitter track and an official track at the same time. And this has also become an issue in news media, more specifically, because of the fact that you've got President Trump, a constant tweeter, always making news with his tweets. And then you've got members of the White House staff saying, why are you paying so much attention to the president's tweets? And so you had these tracks that appear to be separate, or at least somebody's attempting to keep them separate.
Well, I think they want to have it both ways. I mean, we've seen official White House statements that have said that have treated the president's tweets as an official statement, and then others that have said, "Oh, why are you taking this so seriously?" So they clearly are trying to sort of have their cake and eat it too on that. There's a Twitter account, I think it's called PressSecBot or something like that. I can't remember the exact title of it, but what it does is it takes every tweet that Donald Trump tweets and converts it into the format of an official press statement from the White House. Because, you know, there's been a lot of debate about whether or not a tweet is an official statement. Are these his comments as a private citizen, or are these statements by the president?
Well, and then while we're talking about official statements from the White House, it seems like the White House has gone into a bit of a dark mode in terms of news media briefings. The statement, for example, the other day from the White House about Donald Trump Jr.'s release of his emails about the meeting that he took with somebody from Russia. This is taking about three sentences worth of qualifiers, but the official statement from the White House was Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but not on camera. Mm-hmm. It was just an audio statement. And not a lot of briefings from Sean Spicer or anybody else, for that matter, at the podium in the White House these days.
I feel like as a professor, every once in a while you have a student who, while you're teaching or while other people are presenting, they're always saying jokes in the background or in the periphery. And then when you bring them up to the front, like, hey, why don't you talk about what you want to say in front of class, then they get really quiet. I almost feel like that's what's happening. There's a lot of noise on Twitter. Donald Trump's tweeting a lot. But then when we do give him the platform to speak in front of the nation or his the people that work for him, then they're kind of like, and get quiet right now.
Yeah, I really don't understand why the White House press is going along with the whole off-camera briefing thing. From my perspective, the press should be saying, if you're not going to go on camera, we're not going to show up. Or just turn the cameras on and see what happens. What are they going to do, drag you out? That'd be great tape, honestly. So from my perspective, I think it's wrong that the White House is not allowing on-camera briefings for most of the time. And I think the press should be standing up to that.
Is it one of those things that you think where they're playing to a portion of the electorate that thinks, hey, it's okay, you know, those guys are just rude jerks anyway, so therefore why should you offer them any access?
Well, of course. I mean, they still all go obviously on Fox News, where they are getting a friendly audience. Donald Trump just had an interview with Pat Robertson, I think last night
on CBS.
Yeah, so you know, they are going on friendly networks. Although it's also true that CNN, as much as they are sort of the target du jour of the Trump administration, constantly puts on his spokespeople, and they pay them. So it's kind of interesting to me that a network that has been actually has always given a fair voice to the administration's perspective kind of gets singled out in an interesting way. But
I want to differentiate there, though, because the people who get paid are people actually working as commentators for CNN,
yes.
No longer working for
right,
the White
right.
House.
But yeah, but they are people who obviously are very friendly to the administration's perspective. But yes, that's an important distinction to make.
All right, this is our Signals and Noise segments. Our once a month visit with the folks in the communications faculty at SOU, Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi in the studio. So many things to talk about. The media landscape never seems to even get slightly tepid of late. It's always fairly warm to red hot. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Offer up some topics in the media landscape you'd like to discuss. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You said the magic letters, CNN, which brings us back to the other ways in which people will doctor video. And there's a video from quite a few years ago, I guess, of when Donald Trump was involved with World Wrestling and went through this fake deal where he beat up some other guy in a suit just outside the wrestling ring, or appeared to. And so that video was taken, and CNN's logo superimposed over the face of the person who was getting fake pummeled. And this was tweeted by the president of the United States. I mean, how significant is this as either happening in media in America, and certainly as something you can talk about with your students in your classes?
Well, that story alone could be several classes worth of lectures. I mean, we had, first of all, this was something that appeared originally on Reddit by a someone who had posted a number of kind of white supremacist, neo-Nazi type media pieces, and was found by the White House and shared. So that right there is a big thing. Then it was found out that the person who created the meme was actually a troll, and actually came out and later apologized and said, no, I don't actually believe any of these things. I'm sorry for creating this meme. I was just trolling. And then you had a whole story about CNN. They came out and said, we know the identity of this person. We're not going to reveal the identity right now, but we reserve the right to change that if the behavior doesn't change. And a lot of people got very up in arms as to whether or not CNN was basically threatening an anonymous person with exposure if they continue to create media that they didn't like. And so there's First Amendment questions and things like that there. So it's a really complicated story.
It truly is, and it makes you wonder who the person is and what the reasons were that CNN gave for saying, okay, we're not going to say who you are.
Yeah, my understanding was that and the reporter whose name I'm blanking on right now used to work for BuzzFeed. He got a lot of flack because they thought he wrote that sentence, but it was actually CNN corporate that added it to his story, and so he really didn't have anything to do with it. But you know, I'm not sure why. I think their idea, what they claim, was that they were trying to clarify that there was no sort of quid pro quo there going on. I don't know.
It's interesting to get to this point in history, though, where when we talk about media, we're really talking about potentially every person on the planet, or at least every person on the planet who has access to any kind of a computing device, because when we used to talk about the media, it was corporate entities, groups of people anyway, organizations with some money coming in. But the democratization of the media, where anybody can have video editing software that allows them to put a CNN logo over the face of somebody getting pummeled outside a wrestling ring, makes all of this stuff possible in whole new ways. And then there was also the response to that, which showed somebody shot a video where the CNN logo head was talking to the camera and just talking about how hurt its feelings were. And then large tears roll out of the CNN logo, that kind of thing, which apparently didn't take somebody else much time to produce.
It does take time in a certain way, though. There's a lot of free labor that goes into these different types of memes and different types of video editing. And the reason I know is because my husband, he does a lot of those type of video memes for video games. And he'll take about 3 days sometimes and edit them together. So sometimes memes are very easy to put together. Other times people are really thoughtful and work really hard on putting those type of thoughts together into something that is edited that they hope will get retweeted and retweeted or passed on.
Yeah, plus in the case of the person that did the response from the CNN logo, this was something that was acted and scripted and everything. So it wasn't just like applying a sticker over somebody else's video.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a lot of free labor that goes into it. And also, like, in terms of video games and those type of things, we call it modding, in which the community people work as a community or individually to contribute to a community of modding something that might intentionally not have been supposed to have been there, but they take it and they keep modding.
Modding for modifying?
Yeah.
Okay, so sort of like that. We were talking about the flashcards, but like people were doing earlier with President Trump's executive orders, when he turns them around and shows them to the crowd in the Oval Office, and people putting all kinds of things in those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they will teach themselves. It's not just all people who already know have those computer skills. They will teach themselves to do something that they think will make people laugh.
Interesting. So it's like a whole realm of, everybody gets to be a producer. Everybody gets to be a comedian in this media landscape.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's why Facebook and things like Twitter became so popular, were because you didn't necessarily need to have coding skills. That at first, people on the internet, they were the ones that had coding skills, so they could have websites. But now anyone could have a website. Now anyone could get their image out there, get their voice out there. And it's become even more so easier and easier as time has gone on.
Which is such a change for somebody who spent his entire adult life in the media business, most of it in TV. The idea that you had to have a truck. You had to have this thing you mounted on a tripod at the very least to point at your tower to send the microwave signals back to do a live shot in addition to the camera and at least a two-person crew. And now you can pick up your phone, push a button, and you're live on Facebook.
Yeah, or you could teach yourself something new all the time. I mean, I'm not a specialist in coding or anything, but I remember when I was a teenager and getting on the internet, I would teach myself how to manipulate my blog or how to manipulate my MySpace page and how to make it change colors. And I think that's a big part of memes and this social media is you might not know how to get your message out there, but you teach yourself real quick so you can have that little laugh to yourself and your followers.
Yeah, media creation is pretty much a necessary skill in pretty much any job field and just in life these days.
Media creation, obviously beyond just writing that. I mean, we're talking about you need to know how to manipulate video and audio and all that.
Yeah, and you know, I think any student today who's looking for, you know, doesn't matter what career field they're going into, they will be more valuable if they know how to do some of these kinds of media. Because at some point, their company's going to say, does anyone know how to make a meme, right? And you're going to be the one to say, yes, I know how to make a meme. And you're going to hop in there and be useful.
So let's talk about that term. And actually, let me remind our folks, we're this is our Signals and Noise segment. We visit once a month with Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay from the communications faculty at SOU about events in the media, in the media landscape of today, which is pretty much all 7 billion of us. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Not all 7 billion at the same time, please. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Let's pin down that term meme, though, because it gets used in different ways. I understood it to mean originally an idea that seems to spread through the internet, and then it became the pictures with the white blocky letters on them.
Right. So meme was, which Richard Dawkins' term, evolutionary biologist who was looking for, you know, a corresponding term for cultural genes. You know, we have biological genes that spread and evolve, and the useful genes get kept, and the non-useful genes usually get rid of and through natural selection and all that process. His theory was that culture works the same way. That so a meme is basically a piece of culture. And so if you think about like the handshake, at some time someone shook hands for some reason, and either that catches on and propagates or it dies out. And so it's the idea is that is how culture works, the same way that genetics works. And so it's become a useful kind of term for the internet, because anything can be a meme, but now on the internet those kind of cultural ideas spread much more quickly. A meme is a much broader term than what we, it's not just GIFs and image macros, right? It's actually a much bigger thing, but it has become a shorthand for those kinds of things.
Right. So you get the meme creator sites where you get to take somebody's picture and put some funny words on it.
Right. And I have my students do that.
It is interesting how that got so standard, though, so fast. I mean, I think even I can recognize the font. It looks like Impact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It seems standard and almost universal. But then when I have students from different countries, I realize how not universal it is, that all of these images have these loaded contexts that you have to understand the popular culture that's related to them. They have the Exhibit meme, who was a rapper who does Pimp My Ride. But if you've never seen Pimp My Ride, then you have no idea what that meme means.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, is the kinds of images that will evoke responses will be different from culture to culture. And particularly when you get people from other cultures into your room, it's like, it means nothing to me.
Yeah, I don't think memes are always inclusive. They are kind of a snicker towards a group of people with an inside joke.
Right. I mean, they are distinct among subcultures, just as Precious was talking about her husband's video game memes, right? I'm not a gamer, so I wouldn't understand those memes, but it's a way of identifying your subculture group. Mm-hmm. We are unified by the fact that we all get these memes, versus that group over there has different memes and we won't understand their memes.
Like Pepe the Frog and
his
the alt-right, where apparently the person who created Pepe the Frog was, and I wouldn't have known about this if I hadn't heard it on the place I listened to, which is NPR.
Right.
I listened to All Things Considered on the way home one night. I was like, Pepe the Frog, what the hell is all this? And then he explained it all out, but it's one of those things where if you saw Pepe the Frog, you go, okay, cool, they have a frog on it.
Yeah.
So within the broader culture, that subculture, outside that subculture, you wouldn't know.
Yeah, they co-opted a meme that wasn't intended for that.
No, not at all. Well, let's move into some more popular media stuff, because we happen to those of us who do love audio on large platters, notice the fact that Sony is actually making vinyl discs again, which is kind of a big deal, first time in something like 17 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I feel like vinyl has been more popular than CDs in the last few years. I mean, I don't know anyone who buys CDs anymore, but I know lots of people who collect vinyl.
Truly,
yeah.
And also, vinyl allows DJs to be able to mix in a way that has a different type of sound versus digital mixing. So, I know that for a lot of new artists, that having their record on vinyl is exciting for them, because it means that DJs might be able to mix it in a very creative type of way too. But if your album is not on vinyl, then you get left out of that type of DJ mixing.
Mm. Oh, interesting. So it's almost a necessity for some creators at some point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's still wild to see, though. And yeah, we were having a little discussion about this yesterday. Of course, different groups. We were having a discussion with somebody in their 20s and two of us in our, I think we're both in our 50s. No, one of us just turned 60. But, you know, the idea that, you know, the people who grew up with physical media versus the people who don't even really use CDs anymore, talking about this actual tactile land of medium.
Yeah, I think it's been a part of it is an industrial response to the fact that most people don't see a value in particular music We think of music as being this free thing that's out there that we can just access and it's ours. But going back to vinyl, it becomes this designer collector thing, right? That you have this cool looking disc and there's these beautiful liner notes and an awesome album cover. It's a display piece. And so if you're a fan, now I have a reason to go buy that vinyl by my favorite artist. And so it kind of re-engaged fans with actually purchasing media in a way that once MP3s took over, the CD just wasn't doing.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about your pick threes before we finish up the hour here. You got pick threes of things you're enjoying in the media lately?
Yeah. I teach a communication class called Intimacy and Sexual Communication, and that's happening this summer. And we just watched a documentary called Still Doing It, Women and Their Sex Lives, women who are over 65 and their sex lives, and how it's become such a norm in the media to think that a person that is sexy or sexually active is between the ages of 18 and 35. But what happens to when you're 65, 70, 80? And so it talks about all these different women and how they, as one woman said, like she was in her 70s and has never been hornier. So it was really good to have that conversation in class and to know that there's media out there. There's also a comic book that I've been reading. I've never been a big superhero person, but I did want to read comic books about people that have different experience outside of the superhero context. So there's one called The Travelogue from China and Shenzhen is an industrial area city in China.
Not far from Hong Kong.
Yeah, like everything that you get that's plastic, almost everything comes from there. And it's a guy who creates his narrative and experiences in comic book form.
Okay.
And also there's a television show or a series on Amazon called Fleabag, which was from BBC Three.
I have seen it.
Really, yeah. Really, really funny. Mm. I know that it's from a while back, but it's great summer watching.
It really is. Yep. Fleabag, Still Doing It, and Travelogue from China. Andrew, your three?
Yeah, my three are the new Haim album. Just came out this week.
Haim as in Anaheim?
Yes, Anaheim. Precious was helping with the pronunciation.
I love Haim.
It's a girl group of a trio of sisters who write all the music, play, and perform. This is their second album. It's fantastic. If you didn't know the 80s are back, the 80s are back in this music. Master of None on Netflix is Aziz Ansari's series. Is a great series. Really love it. Very funny. Lots of great references to old movies and things like that. And finally, Monument Valley 2 video game for the iPhone is a lot of fun.
Monument Valley 2, Master of None, and Haim. The pick three from Andrew Gay. Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay join us once a month for our Signals and Noise segment, a rousing discussion of items in the media. Thanks again so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you. And,